So today's topic is spiral path. Is the other half, really, of the story of conditionality. During the last two sessions of this very complicated model of the mind that comes from the Pali Canon, you might have thought that because it's so complex that this is how it all is. But it's actually quite the opposite. That model of the mind described samsara, you could say, in traditional Buddhist language. It described the outcome of the workings of the reactive mind. Because our minds can function in this reactive way, feelings become the basis for triggering underlying tendencies, for setting off processes of proliferation. More generally speaking, setting in train wanting, longing, tanha, which leads to a definite sense of who we are, which nevertheless is something that has a very unstable kind of existence, gives us a very fleeting security because it's arisen on conditions, gives our lives not much of a sense of existential security, and leads to dukkha. So we also have, just as part of our mental makeup, a creative kind of tendency in our minds, the tendency to be aware, to notice what's happening, pay attention, be creative. I can't remember the other attributes of the creative mind. It's spontaneous. It's not automatic, I suppose, and so on. And that's what we're going to explore today. It can seem sometimes in the way we present the spiral path in Tri Ratna that we have a set of factors arranged in a linear fashion which join up with the previous set of nidanas arranged in a linear fashion, so that we've got on condition of ignorance a lot of stuff associated with samsara culminating in full-on dukkha, on condition of which arises faith and joy and so on, which is all great, leading up to enlightenment. But even a moment's reflection will indicate that this just isn't how it is. We are always involved, while we're not awakened and liberated, in various kind of tendencies and habits and so on, giving rise to craving, underlying tendencies, proliferation, pain, and in the midst of that, right in the midst of it, we engage with the path. Isn't that how it is? We can't step out of, you know, neaten up our lives and say, ah, there's the dukkha, now we'll get on the path. It's right in the midst of it we try to give rise to the path. With that in mind, when we're talking about sets, conditions arising on one another, as it were, that's simply a way of looking at things, a way of putting things that makes sense to our minds. It doesn't correspond to the reality of the experience. So let's just get an overview first of the spiral path. I've put joy there because I wanted to. There's no other reason. So I'll just sketch the 12 familiar factors of the path, familiar if you've studied this. Dukkha, the first factor, faith, joy, rapture, tranquility, not that I can spell it, bliss, concentration, am I getting it right? Mm-hmm. let's just call it insight, knowing and seeing things as they really are. Disenchantment, dispassion. Very hard to get the spacing right on a big piece of paper. Liberation, and finally, knowledge of liberation. So 12 factors, starting from dukkha, ending at knowledge of liberation. It's a slightly, it's a list that you can raise a lot of questions about. It crops up a few times in the Pali Canon, but there are actually quite a few other ways in which the Buddha presents a path to awakening. You might have heard of the seven factors of awakening, the seven bojangas. And they're a parallel list of seven factors which are said to arise one after the other. They go, can I remember without having prepared? they go, rapture, no, they start with investigation, that's it, investigation of phenomena, followed by energy, followed by rapture, which is the same as here, followed by tranquility, followed by bliss, followed by concentration, culminating in equanimity, upeka. So it's obviously related, but the Buddha never sort of says, well, how does this relate to that? We just have, it's just obvious that there are different ways of expressing this path with some common factors. And you might also ask, well, what's the relation between the spiral path and the Noble Eightfold Path? Yeah? And this is perhaps a more important question, really. How do you tie these two together? And again, the Buddha never quite explains it. But I think this is more obvious. Or there's a more important principle behind it, which is worth getting to thinking about. We heard in the Fourth Noble Truth that the way to the cessation of dukkha is the Noble Eightfold Path, which consists in right view, which is what we're working on, developing, thinking about here, right intention, right speech, action, livelihood, right effort, mindfulness, concentration. But the way the Buddha talks about this, it's really clear that to practice this path, you give rise to each of these factors at the same time, yeah, or all together. There are eight different factors of what you need to develop. I mean, that's pretty complex. That's a tall order, isn't it? But nevertheless, that's the way it's presented. In practice, we might start with right view and work on our right speech, action, livelihood, and work on our meditation. But in principle, it's not as though one arises, then the next. They're all things you need to work on. And in a way, when a Buddha hasn't sort of finished with the Noble Eightfold Path, it just becomes that which he is living with all the time. That makes sense. Again, it's a funny idea to call it a path. It's more like it's a way that one gives rise to. So much for the Eightfold Path as what we make an effort to do. But what then might our experience be as we give rise to those eight factors? And I think it's this that the spiral path gives us a sense of. These are stages of experience that we might go through as we practice the Eightfold Way. Does that make sense? It's slightly complex, but it's important, I think, isn't it? In the sense that what we make an effort at doing is cultivating the eight factors of the Eightfold Way. And the results of doing that might be our experience of moving through these stages of experience. That's how I link up these two ideas of the path. So, looking,
So you can see the Eightfold Way as a kind of vehicle.
Vehicle, yeah.
Like a little car you get in.
Yep.
And you travel along the spiral path, which is more of a linear thing. So the spiral path's more linear, and the Noble Eightfold Path / Way is more a way of doing something.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice. So it's just an image, isn't it? What you said, it's just an image, but it's a quite a nice image. You get in the Noble Eightfold car, yeah, with its eight wheels and eight mirrors, eight seats, whatever. Going to, I don't know how it drives. It's very difficult to drive. And somehow you steer it along the spiral, linear kind of path. Yeah. It gives a set. It's a nice image for giving a sense of the difference. That's the point, isn't it?
Breaks down a lot, Robbie's cab.
Yeah.
You're a bit getting out and fixing it and calling the repair.
That's the problem. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes the Eightfold Path is imagined as a flower, isn't it, with eight petals, or seven if you put right view in the middle. And it's something that opens, is that right? And when it's fully open, that's, as it were, the state of awakening.
Yeah. Stephen, can I just ask a question right away that's always bugged me about the spiral path?
Yes.
Are these states...
Are they
states that you only experience during meditation, or are they states that appear in your life?
So are the factors of the spiral path things we experience in meditation or in life?
Particularly, I'm thinking of, say, rapture.
Yeah.
This, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, are we actually walking around with these
feelings,
or is it only meditation?
They're very much things we experience in our lives. You might... Have a much better chance of experiencing some rapture in meditation, but nevertheless, that's simply one part of our lives where we might experience this particular stage. Let's get on to the details, because I think this will become apparent to what degree these things are specific to meditation or have a more sort of general meaning. Now, I'm going to propose that we can divide up the spiral path into three parts. And these three parts are the first part culminating in joy. The second part culminating in insight. And the third part leading up to liberation and knowledge of liberation. And I feel that I'm on firm ground here, because in the Pali Canon there are a lot of occurrences of a sequence of stages leading from rapture through tranquility, bliss and concentration to insight. They occur as a list in all sorts of contexts. So clearly they were preserved as a sequence of experiences, as it were, independent of the other two. And so I like to think of these as the integration series. It's a series of factors which denotes, as it were, or describes the spiritual integration process, culminating. So concentration really means complete integration of our being, and that culminates in insight. Then these earlier three experiences, dukkha, faith and joy in this case, are the beginning of the path. They're let's just call it the beginning of the path. And I'm going to talk a bit more about this stage, because there are other formulations which are useful in our thinking about how does the path start, what kinds of experiences happen at the beginning of the path. Then at the other end, the links, the factors from insight, well, following insight, disenchantment, dispassion, liberation and knowledge of liberation. These are again a series that we find in lots of different contexts in the Pali Canon as unfolding out of insight. So there are a lot of different practices that the Buddha recommends which lead to insight, to knowing and seeing things as they really are. And what unfolds out of that is a sort of spiritual process, beginning with disenchantment, the spell of the world being broken, as it were, moving on to dispassion, a sense of being less involved in those things which previously enthralled us, to liberation, the freeing up of our being from that which previously bound us, and culminating in knowledge of liberation, which is to say knowing that the work is done. The work is done, and that obviously equates to enlightenment. So we're talking very high, you know, far along sort of achievements here. And in some ways, once insight arises, the unfolding of the subsequent factors isn't something anybody does, if that makes sense. There's been a lot of talk in Sri Ratna about a suprapersonal force, a stream of the Dharma which unfolds, leading to don't know where it leads to, it's an image for what happens after the arising of insight, as it were. A force or stream carries the us onwards to enlightenment. It's an image which gives us a sense of how that this isn't really a matter of effort. It's rather high up experience. I don't know if we'll necessarily get on to discussing it today, but I thought I'd mention it to give you a sense of where it's all going. Go.
Just from my notes, could you just yep. This last, the period is the cut off.
Where's the cut off, as in? It's between insight and disenchantment. So once...
Knowing and seeing reality. We've got on the
sheet. Yeah, sorry. Knowing and seeing reality. Another phrase to describe the insight experience. Once that's arisen, what happens after that is an unfolding, really, of the implications of insight. So in the different formulations, some insight can be a kind of overlapping factor. I don't want to burden you with too much stuff about texts and how to make sense of all the different texts, because it's very technical and not very interesting. I want to give you just what it all means, but it involves explaining to some degree what's in the texts. So, looking at our handout, it's a slightly difficult handout. It's not self-evident what I'm getting at here. I think it's because it's a slightly complicated situation, but hopefully, as you're now familiar with the ground, as it were, what I'm getting at will become apparent. So, in our sort of Sri Ratna standard formulation of the spiral path, we always start from dukkha, the basic situation of unsatisfactoriness, and the path is then said to begin with faith. Faith or sadha, which you could also translate trust or confidence. Faith is a funny old word, isn't it, in English? It can have unfortunate kind of implications of belief or a somehow not very rational process. Whereas sadha, in fact, let's just write trust, doesn't imply any such... belief or assent to authority so much as a felt sense of what you can trust, of a heart response to a teaching which is going to be helpful. and that can be explored intellectually as well as developed emotionally. And arising from faith is joy, paramoja. I've thought a bit about paramoja recently, thinking, well, what does that mean? What does it mean in Pali, paramoja? It just means kind of joy. But in English, it's a very unspecific word, isn't it? It's not even necessarily a particularly wholesome word, is it? You could feel joy when you won 108 million quid on the lottery, couldn't you? And presumably, the people that do that do feel a certain kind of joy. But what is that? It's nothing very, very wholesome, is it? And maybe, you know, a criminal could feel really, you know, a fantastic sense of joy having done a bank job without getting caught or without having to kill anybody. You know, oh, fantastic, done it. So what are we talking about here? And it strikes me that we have to sort of read into here. Firstly, a sense that this is a kind of spiritual joy, a samaparamoja, a right or perfect joy. And secondly, that it means something quite simple, just the sense of things going as you'd like them. Something very straightforward, a sense of having found what you were looking for. Yeah, nothing more complicated than that, I don't think. It's not like it's not like the product of a meditation experience or necessarily anything more sophisticated than the relief and joy of finding some meaning, some finding a path, finding something that your heart trusts as a way through life. What do you think? Does that make a certain sense? Talking about a very, in a way, ordinary experience, but one specifically connected with the process of the path. I think that's the only way to make sense of what it's doing here, this link, because we're about to get on to rapture and bliss, and it's got to be a different thing from those.
There's a sense of relief from being caught in something.
Yeah. So, relief. Joy can imply relief from being caught up. Yeah. The pleasure of escaping. It's not as though we've actually completely escaped, but that, you know, you can think, well, at least I've opened the window. Yeah. And this, with this in mind, let's look at some other formulations of the beginning of the path, because I think it'll become clearer what the Buddha was getting at. So this formulation, dukkha face joy, is only found once in the Pali Canon, in the Upanishad Sutta, which I have mentioned, which is the one which links up the 12 Nidanas with the spiral path, the only sutta in the entire Pali Canon that does that. But there's three or few more, a bit repetitive, other discourses. No, there's several other discourses which present different beginnings to the path. They each result in joy and then continue through the integration series and the insight series, but they start rather differently, not from faith, but from a different factor. So in the diagram, you can see that the diagram at the top, I've indicated, I wish I'd done this a bit more clearly now, that one starting point for the path is the practice of ethics, sila. Yes, and this is said to lead to freedom from remorse. So with the practice of ethics, this condition arises freedom from remorse. And freedom of remorse is the condition that which results in joy. So the option number one in the list just below, I've given a variety of ways in which the Buddha describes the beginning of the path. For someone who abandons the five hindrances, or who abandons defiled mental and emotional states, or who lives with moral attentiveness, or who practices ethical conduct and then experiences freedom from remorse, for those people, joy is born. So the Buddha gives a sort of range of different things that lead to joy. And I think this makes a lot of sense, because it's a lot clearer why one would experience joy if it arises on condition of freedom from remorse. So it's as if you might hear the Dharma, let's say, and it strikes a chord, and it leads you to take up the practice of ethics to sort out your life. Yeah? I think that's the suggestion. You take on the precepts, live with moral attentiveness, as it were. Start attending to, what kinds of mental states are wholesome, lead to good consequences, and which kinds of mental states are not very wholesome. What kinds of behaviours am I involved with, which are really I'm not very proud of, let's say, or I know that don't really help, and which ones are really in line with my own ideals, my own values. And that process carried through, I'm sure you've all, I mean, all human beings are involved with this to some degree. I think it just gets a bit more intensified once you get involved with a spiritual movement which focuses on this. What happens is you start to sort yourself out, yeah? And you start to therefore experience a freedom from remorse. A freedom from a sense that you've done wrong. I really like this phrase, avipatisara. It simply means not thinking back on bad things. That makes sense. Because actually, you know, you're living in a fairly wholesome way, sorted out your basic values, no longer putting your foot in it quite as often as you did. So you experience a sort of general sense of good conscience, sense of clarity and ease. And that's the condition for this joy that we were talking about, a sense of relief, sense perhaps of escaping from how one was. A sense of well-being. There's another way in which the Buddha talks about the beginning of the path, and that's number three, option three here. And again, I've got various options because this crops up in various different discourses. So, for someone who pays wise attention, or who practices mindfulness of the body, kaya gata sati, that's a nice one, or who gains enthusiasm from the six recollections, which is to say the recollection of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, generosity, the gods, and another one. Might be ethics. No, that's right. So again, recollecting the three jewels would be the basic six. So for someone who pays wise attention, joy arises. This is another starting point. So you can see in my diagram at the top, the loop at the top I've called wise attention. I mentioned wise attention during the first reflection period. It's a very interesting phrase, this. Yoniso Manasikara. Manasikara literally means making in the mind. So we translate it attention. But it has a sort of slightly stronger implication that our experience is in some sense made in the mind, in the sense that what we pay attention to leads to the content, you know, gives rise to what we experience to some degree. That this point came out when we were considering contact as a factor in the 12 Nidanas. The forces that drive your attention to count the white ball being passed led to you not noticing the gorilla, for instance. So what we pay attention to determines what ends up being noticed in our experience, what, you know, our experience being a certain way. So in that sense, attention, manasikara, is quite a strong term. And yoniso means according to origin, or yoni. So if I put according to origin, a yoni is a womb. Great word, isn't it? Yoni, according to origin. So according to the starting point of things. So paying attention to the according to the origins of things means looking into where things start from. Yeah? Looking into how things start off in our experience. I know from what you were saying earlier that some of you have been looking into, you know, like some situations in your lives. Yeah? Relationships with other people. And noticing, looking into what, how did they start off, but what are they like? Looking into things according to their origins and discovering things like, well, what did you say, Julia? It's like you can't change somebody necessarily. You can't fix it. And now that's a product of yoniso manasikara, paying attention according to the origins of things. So hence, when we translate this wise attention, we're using the word wise in a kind of a way which is sort of works in English, but isn't really quite a translation either. So it's worth knowing what this phrase yoniso manasikara really means. And this kind of wise attention, I do think of it as a kind of mindfulness practice or related to mindfulness practice. The Buddha also mentions how the path arises for someone who practices mindfulness of the body, which is to say taking attention into the body, as it were grounding your thinking in your embodied experience, which is going to have a similar kind of effect, perhaps, to wise attention in taking you from, certainly from certain kinds of proliferative processes. And just to go over this second option, there's for someone who experiences faith and who's developed experiential trust, avecha prasada, in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. For that person, the factor of faith will arise. So now you can see we've got sort of several starting points, three groups of starting points, really, for the spiral path, for the spiritual life.
Can you tell me something about this phrase of avecha prasada?
Oh yeah. So the when we, I'll just fill in the background for the sake of the recording. So, so when in the Upanishad Sutta we see that on condition of faith, Sutta arises joy. That's one link. To fill it in with this phrase, Avecha Pasada, kind of fills out the detail a bit. So, Avecha is a word which means having gone into, really, or having gone into might be a good way to put it in English. Having really understood, having confirmed. And pasada is a word for faith, which really means clarity. Clarity or even brightness. So the clarity that arises from having gone into things. I think translators have had a real job putting Avecha Pasada into English, and experiential trust is one way to put it into English, but it's not great, is it? Bhikkhu Bodhi says confirmed confidence. Confirmed confidence, which is pretty good, but it sounds a bit too strong to me, to my mind. I have confirmed confidence in Jehovah. Whereas Avecha Pasada presumably refers to someone who's really checked out, gone into things with Yoniso Manasikara. You know, made their faith something that they've looked into. It's good, isn't it? It's said, by the way, that somebody with Avecha Pasada, with confirmed confidence, experiential trust in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, is in fact a stream entrant. It's one definition of stream entry, which gives us a sense of how this sense of stream entry, of being irreversibly involved with the spiritual life, isn't necessarily a very something very far away, as it were. It might be something that anybody on retreat could come to. I'm not saying you will or that we have, but it's not necessarily remote. I think these ways of approaching the beginning of the path are useful because we're all different. There's a kind of classic distinction between personality types in Buddhism, between the faith type, the wisdom follower, and the body witness. The faith type, someone who responds with a kind of emotional response of simple faith in what they've heard of the Dharma. There's a certain kind of person who, because of their temperament, finds it of great interest, yeah, of great interest and really worth thinking through. And that leads them to the idea that, yes, I believe this to be the case. That's the wisdom follower. And there's the body witness who finds meditation really fascinating, and by going into meditation directly experiences the truth of what has been taught. So not emotionally or only or intellectually only, but directly. I know when I started getting interested in Buddhism, it was very much just a straightforward faith response, actually. I read a book on the Dharma and just had this immediate sense of, oh yes, this really sounds right. But then I'm also a strongly thinking sort, so I set to work on that, checking it out, and I think that means that for me I'm now very much a sort of wisdom follower. I think about everything, but underneath it is a very strong sort of faith response. I don't know, I'm saying that to say that we're quite complex. None of us can be just slotted into a category, I don't think. So with some sort of response to the path by way of faith, wise attention, or ethical involvement, ethical practice, arises joy. So now things get really interesting. Yeah, it's not necessarily the case that these factors will develop automatically, but it's more like, for instance, when you come on retreat, when you really make a point of working on the spiritual path, on developing the Eightfold Path, these factors may describe your experience. So here's the description the Buddha gives of what happens next. For someone who started the path, joy is born. This relief, this sense of having found what you're looking for. For the joyful, rapture is born. For the rapturous, the body calms down. One with body calmed experiences happiness. For the happy, the mind becomes concentrated. So this is a series which the Buddha quite often puts in exactly this form. It's like a very formulaic passage. It's as if it's quite important that these factors slide into each other. So the concentrated mind, which is what we'd really like, because it gives rise to insight, has got conditions. And let's go through these. So, on to the next one. Happy birthday, Janet. Piti, or rapture. This word in Pali, piti, or priti in Sanskrit, some of you may come across. Actually, often it just means joy in the language. You know, in English it's just the same. We've got these words, joy, bliss, happiness, which we use very interchangeably. But what we're interested in here is a specific technical meaning that the word has in the Buddhist path. And that's a physical exhilaration felt in the body with different degrees of intensity. It could be just the sort of tingling of the hairs on your arm, or it could be the pervading of your whole body with intense rapture that corresponds to a release of emotional energy. Sangharakshita is very good at this, describing how rapture is connected with the release of emotional tension. So I think he gets this from his reading in psychodynamic theory, especially Wilhelm Reich and people like this, who describe how we tend to store our personalities as tensions in the muscles in the body. Our past experiences, which we haven't managed to deal with, get stored as tensions. And certainly we experience this with stress, don't we? We store up our difficulties as tensions in the body. And these are often unconscious. We don't necessarily notice anymore where we're holding tension. And in the situation, especially of meditation, but it could be listening to music, having a conversation, out walking in nature, these tensions can start to unwind and release. And this is experienced as rapture. Have any of you experienced anything like this? Kind of just strong release of tension. It's not that unusual, and we don't need to think it has to be like ever so intense. It could be mild, yeah. It could be that you're having a sauna or a bath, and there's just a sense of letting go, and something gives, yeah, something relaxes. In the Buddhist path. We usually experience this in meditation because that's where Buddhists put a lot of attention, as it were. I've experienced very strong rapture in meditation. And the significance of it is that with the giving up of emotional tension stored, as it were, unconsciously, our attention, our being, becomes more into the moment, becomes more expansive. We feel more of what's actually happening. We're more grounded, can be more aware. So you can already sense the beginning of an integration process with this kind of rapture. Then follows Pasadhi, which we translate as tranquility, or sometimes calm. But really, when we talk about calming down here, what we're talking about is the ebbing away of rapture to leave a genuinely relaxed sense of experience. Yeah, with the ebbing away of emotional tension, there's a genuine, genuinely more relaxed bodily experience. Buddhism is very physical, isn't it, in a sense? The path is quite physical. Sangharakshita, again, very good on this, translates Pasadhi as integrated exhilaration. You could imagine walking on a high mountain ridge, having been walking for weeks, yeah? It's been a long holiday. You've let go of all your work stress. You're on the high mountain ridge and you're exhilarated. Yeah, you're right there. You're not thinking about anything else. This is Pasadhi, integrated exhilaration. And in meditation, it feels just the same, except much quieter. That's Pasadhi. On condition of this arises bliss or sukha. Sukha just means happiness or well-being. Again, it's a very unspecific term, but in this context, it's a bit like the jhana factors here. Sukha is a non-physical sense of well-being. So the more physical aspects of exhilaration and rapture die away. As you unwind, as your energies become untangled, the body calms down, and then, but that those experiences of rapture and exhilaration die away. And what's left is a much more subtle, but in a sense more satisfying sense of simple emotional well-being. And this is sukha or bliss. Or happiness. And then it's said that for one who is happy, concentration arises. And the word here is samadhi. So it's not as though concentration always arises for somebody who's experiencing bliss and well-being, but it's as it were, if that's the mental intention you've set up, this is where it can go. And if you don't have the quality of bliss and well-being, the mind is not very likely to become fully concentrated. That's the important connection, I think, is that if you'd like to have a really concentrated mind, just work on the preceding factors. Just start on the rapture, which will become tranquility, will become bliss. Now, this word samadhi means to put together. It means putting together, I suppose. So concentration can have some particular sort of resonances in English of a kind of forced attention to a particular object. And in fact, in Buddhism, we can talk about a miccha samadhi, a wrong samadhi. I like this. It's the concentration of the hitman. Yeah? Anybody likes hitman movies? Do you like hitman movies, Steve?
I never watch movies.
No. So there's some really good ones, which some of them are. They usually dwell on, don't they, the intense, fierce ability to concentrate of the hitman, which is morally sort of highly ambivalent. You need to be able to completely relax into kind of sighting this person, cut off from your emotions, in order to be a good hitman or hitwoman. But this, of course, is wrong concentration. And sama samadhi is something very different. It's what arises through a holistic kind of process. Sama samadhi is perhaps concentration becomes not quite the right word. And the root of samadhi in putting together might make us want to talk more about integration. So it's an experienced sense of integration, just being one single entity, fully present, fully aware, without proliferation, without distraction, without one's energies being dissipated or one's emotions being absent. Sounds good, doesn't it? So once the stage of samadhi is reached, of course, again, it's not necessarily the case that in human experience samadhi leads to insight, but for someone on the Buddhist path with who's studied the Buddhist teachings, who's perhaps set up a mental intention to try and understand the nature of reality, this is the state you want to be in, isn't it? To have an integrated, concentrated mind, because it's the integrated mind which is capable of sustained investigation, as it were, looking into things. So, you know, perhaps you're sitting in meditation, perhaps thinking about the five skandhas that we were reflecting on last night. Well, usually this five skandhas reflection is part of a strategy for looking into our experience and asking, where is my self? Is it in form, or is form in it? Is it contained in form, or in our physical form, or is somehow self behind physical form? And all these options, when you look into them, turn out to be not the case. And one can go through the all five skandhas, reflecting in this kind of way, discovering that there's no permanent unchanging self, for instance. And this is usually how the five skandhas are presented, as an object for this kind of reflection. But this kind of reflection won't really go to a complete resolution if the mind isn't integrated. If it is integrated, if the mind is completely present, this kind of reflection can be very powerful for bringing about a strong insight into, wow, this is how it is. I don't have to worry about fixing my ego, because there's no unchanging part of my experience. It's all simply a process. And the end result of this kind of insight reflection is, this is a lovely Pali phrase, Yatha Bhuta Jnana Dasana. So if anybody asks you what you're doing in meditation, you could say, well, I'm developing my Yatha Bhuta Jnana Dasana, which means knowing and seeing what has become just as it is. Knowing and seeing reality just as it is. So it's not as though there's a reality which is separate from just this, yeah, that you somehow get to notice. The word bhuta just means what has become. So everything arises on conditions, everything in the world, everything in your experience. Knowing and seeing just that process as it is, yatha, is insight. Dasana. Dasana means seeing or insight. So, in a way, this path represents, I suppose, the different experiences that the creative tendency of the mind can go through or develop. Yeah, we're all familiar with this creative tendency, the part of the mind that thinks a new thought, is able to be aware, is spontaneous, intuitive, and so on. But we don't always put it to work in a systematic spiritual discipline. Once, if we do put it to work in that way, these are the series of experiences that can arise. I imagine you've got quite a few questions. Like, one question is, well, do these sort of unfold like naturally? How do these things unfold? Will they unfold because I want them to, or not? Does that make sense? And I think the answer is quite some. Quite hard to say, but here's a clue in this particular sutta. We'll end with this, just looking at this particular discourse. It's a discourse called Is It Necessary to Be Willful? And this idea of willfulness is something that gets quite important if you've done some intense meditation. It can be a tendency to try too hard in meditation. Nayaka's suggested this, the effort of the albatross, as an image for how to consider the right kind of effort in meditation. And but of course, sometimes we don't get that right and we try too hard. We're like a flapping pigeon or something, trying to get across the ocean, but we soon run out of steam. So is it necessary to be willful? We could ask, what kind of effort do we need to put in to develop along this spiral path? And what the Buddha comments on this is like this. For someone who is ethical monks, someone established in virtuous conduct, it is not necessary to be willful, wishing, may I have freedom from remorse. It's natural, monks, that for someone who is ethical and who is established in virtuous conduct, that freedom from remorse arises. He goes on like this through all the different links of the spiral path. So you can see the next paragraph. For someone who is free from remorse, monks, it's not necessary to be willful, wishing, may I feel joy. It's natural, monks, that in someone who is free from remorse, joy is born. And so on. So in the end, you know, it's not necessary to be willful, wishing, may I know and see reality. It's natural, monks, for someone who is concentrated, they know and see reality. This doesn't exactly answer our question, does it? Because you might think, well, then how do these things arise? And I think that's just how it is. It's something we have to sort of think about and live with, that actual development through the spiral path, the experience of the stages of the spiral path will occur according to a natural process, and it's not one that will particularly respond to willfulness, but will happen in its own time. Our spiritual development will happen in its own time as our whole beings are ready, as it were, for the next experience. And our job is simply to put the effort in at developing the qualities we need to develop at any moment. That's what we can do. And that's plenty, really, isn't it? You know, if we lack some ethical sensibility, that's the thing to work on. And we'll know if we're doing well because we'll experience joy. If we aren't able to get concentrated in meditation, perhaps, you know, we can work at our ethics. We can simply develop a sense of a grounded bodily awareness. And maybe we'll start to experience some rapture, some emotional release. And that's what we need to be doing. And then, you know, eventually a concentrated mind will be the outcome. So in this way, the spiral path is kind of separate from ourselves. It's a sort of model again. It's a model of what can happen in our experience according to the unfolding of the creative mind. And one which is very useful for us to know about. If we know about it, if we know the stages, we can recognise what's happening. And even more usefully, perhaps decide what we need to work on in order for the path to develop further. So I think I'll stop there. The spiral path is a really fascinating sort of topic for study, and we've just opened up the basics here, but hopefully there's plenty to talk about in our discussion groups.